They're calling me.
The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world from the perspective of our kind of Catholic thought, our Catholic vision, our Catholic social teaching. And we say just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This week, throughout the nation, so many of people are focusing on what's going on in the Gulf Coast in Texas and Houston, Corpus Christi, Rockport, those places, because of the devastation of Hurricane Harvey. And, as we're taping a little bit before you hearing this, so things change as we do it. But I'm going to talk a little bit about Harvey a little bit later on, what Catholic Charities is doing, how people can contribute if they want to, and some of the things that we might be looking forward to in the future. So we'll do that with the understanding that things are very much in flux. Obviously, our thoughts, our prayers go out to the people in that part of Texas. And now it seems in Louisiana because of the movement of the storm. So it's a very sad time for the people there, sad time for our country. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the show. But we're also going to speak about today, and I'm delighted that in the studio here we have two guests, Karen Asher, who is the Chief Program Officer of Catholic Guardian Services, and Kelly Agnew Barajas, who is the Director of Refugee Resettlement for Catholic Charities. And we're going to speak about a very, very interesting phenomenon, which is the wave of kids from Central America that have been coming into the United States in recent years. And we'll talk a little bit about one of the changes that affected a small part of that program just very recently, and to get a better understanding of what's going on in that situation. And then later on in the show, we're going to kind of continue our conversation about what's going on with immigrants and what's going on with refugees. We're going to speak with a senior fellow at the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institute, a senior fellow there, Vonda Felbaugh-Brown. And we're going to talk about the big talk that's been going on all around by the wall. I mean, it's certainly it's intriguing to me that that talk around the wall kind of continues in, give or take, the same area that now this devastating hurricane has coming to. So that's what we're going to be speaking about today. And, I'm just delighted that we have both Kelly and Karen in the studio with us today. So let's go right to them and talk to them about the situation of unaccompanied minors. Just to give our listeners a little bit of background, and we've spoken about this in the past, the law in the United States basically says that if a minor shows up at the border, and the minor is not from a country next door, namely Mexico, then the person kind of the minor has to be let in, and you have to check out whether or not the person is fleeing a situation in which it would be very dangerous for the person to go back or not. And while you're figuring all of that out, you have to figure out how that person gets taken care of and how they are cared for in the United States during that period of time. That's a grossly simplistic notion of what's happening, but our law does recognize that there are humanitarian needs when kids show up at the border and you can't just kind of throw them back. You have to kind of let them into the country. And both Kelly's organization, Catholic Charities Community Services, and Karen's organization, Catholic Guardian Services, has been providing a lot of the services to those groups for a few years now to make sure that the kids are well taken care of while they're here. So Kerry and Karen, thank you so much for being here. One of the things which, and Karen, let me start with you, is one of the things that I think might be a little bit of a surprise to our listeners, that even though these kids are kind of fleeing some very, very difficult situations in Central America, there are actually many of them are being reunited with their kind of family members when they get to the United States. That, I don't think, is what most people know. So how come that's the situation? How does that? Aren't they fleeing their families in Central America? How is it that they're reunited here with their families?
So many of the kids are fleeing violence in their home countries. Most of the kids are fleeing violence in their home countries. Oftentimes, their parents are already in this country, and so they're living in their home country with a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle. And because of the violence there, the family makes the decision to send them north. And when they get to this country, they usually come with the name of the person that they're supposed to go to, the adult, whether it's a parent or another family member or a godparent or a family friend. And then it's our responsibility and our program to do background checks on that sponsor and to ultimately reunite them with that sponsor.
So what is it? You began to hint at it. What's the role of Catholic Guardian Services when kind of working and helping the kids who wind up here?
So Catholic Guardian Services runs two different types of shelter programs for unaccompanied children. And our role, once they come to us, they're still in the custody of the U.S. custody, but they come to us in our shelters. And our role is to do background checks and to assess both the needs of the child as well as the sponsor or multiple sponsors sometimes, because sometimes it turns out that the first sponsor is not a safe placement for them. But ultimately, our role is to provide for their needs while they're with us, school, healthcare, food, shelter, and then to also work with them and their families to ensure that they're going to an appropriate sponsor that's both a safe placement and is going to ensure that the kids come to court and do what they need to do on the legal side once they're released from our custody.
Now, the Catholic Guardian Services has been around for well over 100 years, and it has provided such very high-quality services to kids over that period of time. One of the things it does is provides kind of foster care services and maybe even more residential services in the past. But usually, aren't the kids with the Catholic Guardian Services either in foster care or whatever for a year or two? Isn't that kind of the usual amount of time that kids would have been in foster care?
That is true with our state and city foster care programs. They're in care generally for about 1 to 2 years with us. But in this program, this is a short-term shelter program. The kids are generally with us for between 30 and 60 days as we work with the families to release them to their sponsors. For the children in our program, in the unaccompanied children program that do not have sponsors, they can move into long-term federal foster care. We also have a program for that we just started. But the majority of kids, 95% of kids, get released to their sponsors.
So so with most of the kids whom Catholic Guardian Services has taken care of in the past few years, they've been with you for a month or two. Is that all?
That's right.
Is that enough time to basically be able to kind of work with them after the pretty traumatic journey that they've made from Central America?
It's a start. I mean, our kids come to us severely traumatized. The journey alone is extremely traumatic for actually all of these kids, plus the circumstances that led them to leave their home. And the fact that they left home, these are young kids, and it's hard, you know, they're going to a place where they don't know anyone, no one speaks their language, and they're alone, and they're scared. And so we do start the work, the therapeutic clinical work with them, with our clinicians, but obviously they need some longer term work, which we try to set up with the family before we release them to the sponsor.
Now, do you do any work with the kids after they're placed with their families?
We do not. There are other federal programs that do aftercare work with the families.
Okay. Kelly Agnew Barajas is the Director of Refugee Services for Catholic Charities in New York. Kelly, you and your people are working with the same kids, but you're not helping them in where they're living. You're doing other things for them. So what are you and your staff doing with these same kids while Catholic Guardian Services and other agencies are kind of providing them with a safe place to live?
Right. So some of the work that we do, Karen just described, which is these very intensive home studies, once the child is going to be released to that sponsor, then our agency, in addition to doing the home studies, will also follow up. So that involves going to the home multiple times, depending on how old the child is, or until they reach 18 or eventually gain status. So we actually do have some cases that we've been visiting them for a number of years. And really it is exactly those types of follow-up services that were just being described, in terms of making sure that they get enrolled in school, making sure that they're connected with an attorney, to really look more deeply into the types of legal relief that they might have, making sure that they have medical care and access to insurance, and really more, on the emotional side, is really talking with their sponsor, whether it's a family member that they've been, not with for many, many years, about how they're going to negotiate going forward this relationship. How are they going to address house rules for maybe a 14-year-old girl that hasn't had structure, or has only been, with an elderly grandparent? How are they going to, deal with lots of issues that come up, have to do with younger siblings in the house that are U.S. citizen children, and the mixed status families are really figuring out how they're going to become a family.
We're speaking with Kelly Agnew Barajas, who's the Director of Refugee Resettlement for Catholic Charities. And we're speaking with Karen Asher, who is the Chief Program Officer for Catholic Guardian Services. And we're speaking about the hundreds of thousands of kids who fled Central America in recent years, who are now living in the United States. And we're speaking about how those kids make the transition to living in the United States with some of the various services that are being provided to those children. Kelly, there's a pretty innovative program that Catholic Charities has been involved with one of the hospitals to do some of the follow-up work that Karen was talking about. Talk a little bit about that program.
Absolutely. It's a model that we're really proud of. There was a collaboration between Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx and the legal services that Catholic Charities has to really provide wraparound services to the kids. And there's a significant community in the Bronx of Garifuna kids. They're mostly from the northern part of Honduras, and it's an ethnicity that's particularly persecuted. And those kids really take advantage of the medical services that are available. Clearly, there are extensive medical needs if they haven't had access to medical care. And then really addressing the mental health needs by having groups. They have a boys group and a girls group, and they can also see clinicians individually. And then really it's a one-stop shop to be able to also see an attorney who's right there on site up in the Bronx. And that person can get to know them over a series of meetings, and where they'll hopefully open up fully about the types of trauma that they've been through, which actually might help their legal case to show either asylum or special immigrant juvenile status, for example.
Karen, you kind of oversee so many of the different programs of the Catholic Guardian Services. Is there anything particular about this program that is kind of particularly important and poignant?
I think all of us who work in this program and work with this population find the kids, there's something about the kids in this program. They're so humble and they're so grateful to be here. And their stories are so moving. I mean, for all of us.
Can you tell us a story? One of the kids
who
you really kind of think's got a good story?
Well, I'll tell you two stories.
Okay.
I'll tell you one about a boy who came here 11 years old. He crossed the border with his stepfather, and his stepfather got sent back, and he ended up in one of our foster homes. And he was trying to decide whether or not he wanted to be returned back to his family and his home country. And his mother was trying to encourage him to stay here. It was a DV situation at home, so it wasn't really safe for either of them,
domestic
actually.
Domestic violence.
Yes, sorry. And he was going back and forth. And when he was in our program, it was the first time he ever really got to go to school. And he loved school. He just loved everything about being in school. And so when he made his decision, it was really based on the idea that he could stay here and go to school and become an attorney to represent kids like him someday. And so he made the choice to stay here. And it was a hard choice for him not to go back to his parents. But that opportunity and that ability to have something better with his life is why he ended up staying here. So that's one that really, I think, really struck us all. Yeah. And another one, we had a young girl. She was 16 years old. She gave birth to our first UAC baby in our program, who had been horribly abused in the home that she was coming from in this country. Her mother had sent her here to live with a relative who abused her, and she escaped that. She actually escaped that home, tried to cross the border into Canada to be with her mother, and got picked up and had no sponsor here. And she was so horrifically traumatized and was with us actually for a long time because she was pregnant and about to give birth, and ended up just really connecting with my staff and with all of us. She happened to give birth right around Christmas, so it was particularly poignant. And she ended up doing great, also getting re-engaged back in school and being able to parent her child appropriately. And I mean, these are our kids. There's every single one of them has a story like this.
So I'll tell you a story, because one of our other Catholic Charities agents, not a story, I'll tell you a description. That one of our other Catholic Charities agencies, Lincoln Hall, which is a residential campus in northern Westchester, where they have had, you know, usually on any given night, maybe even more than 100 kids who are there going to school. They also, over the years, have had on that campus, its original mission was dealing with some kids who had pretty rough lives and weren't doing too well in school, and quite frankly, had some altercations with some minor crimes and went there as an alternative to actually going to jail. And that was a rough group of kids. It was interestingly, the teachers were delighted with the new unaccompanied minor. She said, they want to learn. You know, and they were finding, because the other kids, so traumatized, they really were hard students to teach. And they maybe had these kids just kind of really were delightful to teach because they wanted to learn. It was just a very different experience for the teachers themselves.
Yeah, we have exactly that experience. We have Department of Education teachers that teach on site at our facility, and they love to teach our kids. Our kids are there to learn. They do not move when they come into the classroom. They just want to learn.
Yeah. So Kelly, you've dealt with a lot of refugees from a lot of different places. You've dealt with some of these kids too. Mm-hmm. Tell us a couple of your favorite kids you've dealt with.
Sure. I actually have a relatively happy, very happy actually, but fresh story. This is really about the refugee program that was started under the Obama administration to consider a handful of these children for potential access to the refugee resettlement program. And we had a case that we were very, very concerned about going back since last summer. We had been, there's a mom who's here in New York, and she actually fled her parents as an unaccompanied minor, came to New York, was eventually granted a green card through special immigrant juvenile status, but she fled and had to leave her young child behind in El Salvador. So she was then becoming more and more alarmed because her little girl was telling her that her grandparents, the same parents that had been abusive to the mom, were now abusing the little girl.
And
now,
how old was the little girl?
She is 6. Okay. So she's almost 7, which of course rings very close to home because I have little ones myself. But So I really felt a strong connection with this mom. And we were raising a lot of concerns through our national partner, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and up through the government entities that really run this program down in Central America about a serious child protection concern. Their only way to deal with this was to actually advise the mother to go down personally and move the child to a different home. You know, a friend, someone that could take care of the child, because the grandparents were obstructing the child from accessing, going to the interviews.
Was this in Texas, you said?
This was in El Salvador.
Oh, in El Salvador.
Yeah.
Right.
So eventually, this was just a very long process of then the person that had taken over from the grandparents was being threatened herself. And it was a long story. But last week, the mom, we had, you know, lots of alarm bells, and we had sent lots of requests to expedite this case and have it considered really as soon as possible. And the mom sent me a scanned copy of the approval that this little girl was going to be granted refugee status. I quickly wrote back and just said, you know, felicidades, like congratulations. And then she texted me separately and said, what does it say? Tell me what the letter says. Yeah. So I quickly, you know, just translated the gist of it, that her daughter was now approved as a refugee and we're just waiting for the travel to be booked. So I got this huge emoji with the heart eyes. I mean, she was just thrilled. And, you know, this case is very near and dear to my heart, so I can't wait to meet her in person.
Oh, that's a delightful story. But let's move a little bit since you brought it up. I mean, we hear all of the things that, like, the number of refugees are being cut, and the president has said, you know, half as many refugees or fewer refugees. So is this 7-year-old in affected by that?
She will be allowed to travel.
Okay.
What's the current state of affairs? Of course, there's been a lot of litigation,
right,
as you mentioned, and there was the, you know, the initial ceiling of refugee arrivals, and that was then, you know, more than halved.
Right.
And then there's been a lot of litigation back and forth, right, with the various executive orders. But right now, as it stands, there's a ban on refugees from entering the country that do not have a bona fide relationship.
Okay.
But because she does have a bona fide relationship, which is very clearly shown, we did DNA. I mean, it was all,
right,
like, obviously there's birth certificates. So this case is very clear that she has a mother.
So is the ban on refugees, just for our listeners' edification, on all refugees without a bona fide relationship, or is it only refugees from those 6 or 7 countries?
Right. Yeah, it's very unclear, and
okay,
even the media has a hard time reporting on this. But the way, the simplest way to describe it is, all people from those countries that were identified are banned right now from entering the United States, regardless of status, unless you're a refugee and you have a bona fide relationship.
Right.
Aside from that, all refugees who do not have a bona fide relationship are also banned.
Okay. And again, for the sake of our listeners, let me see if I can say this a little bit, and then Kelly, you get this right. There are two broad categories of refugees, kind of in the world. I mean, really broad. Those who maybe have a family member in another country, and they're being persecuted where they are, and they get refugee status, and they're going to be resettled with their relative in the United States, in Germany, in wherever. The other type are those who are also equally persecuted. They have no place to go. They can't go back to where they are, but they don't have any refugee, and they need a country also. And what you're saying, the current ban, although there is litigation, says, okay, if you have a relationship, then you can come in. But if you don't, then you can't, no matter what country you're from.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. As of right now, there'll be arguments in the Supreme Court on the 10th of October.
Right.
And then the decision hopefully will be forthcoming.
Okay. So listen, Karen, both of you have been generous with your time. Karen, is there one kind of final point or something you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot in the media about our population, the population that my agency serves. And I just have to say that our experience of serving over 500 children in this program, if we've had two that have been in any way related to a gang, that would be a lot. That the media, I think, is portraying these kids and this population in a way that just doesn't apply to 99.9% of them. And I think that that's important for people to understand.
Karen, that's a really, really good clarification to make, because the reality is none of us want gangs. Nobody wants gang violence. We should do whatever we can to try to make sure there isn't gang violence. But at the same time, we can't say that everybody is a member of a gang. So, Kelly, one final thought?
Yeah, I would echo that same concern. But I would also say, you know, lately there's been just a tremendous amount of fear. It's just generalized fear amongst the families that I don't think is helping our community in any way, to have people afraid to go to court, have people afraid, to go to the hospital, afraid to go to school. So I'd like to see these families be able to, integrate as they should into our society.
Thank you. Kelly Agnew-Barajas, the Director of Refugee Settlement for Catholic Charities of New York, and Karen Asher, the Chief Program Officer of the Catholic Guardian Services, both agencies doing tremendous work in welcoming and integrating the kids who are coming here because of very, very difficult situations in Central America. Thanks for being with us, and more important, thanks for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, this is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just, and it will be more compassionate. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and we're going to come back in just a moment or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Lone Star, where are you? Out tonight.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just, and it will be more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. And kind of this week, we're talking about some refugee kids who are coming from Central America. And a little bit later on in the show, we're going to be speaking about, the wall that is being proposed by President Trump to secure the border with Vanda Felbaugh-Brown, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. But I do want to spend a little bit of time right now speaking about the natural disaster and tragedy that is in Texas, Hurricane Harvey. And I just want to always say what is so uplifting in almost all of these tragedies that have, you know, plagued or been part of the United States in recent years. And I myself, you know, am old enough to know, you know, three of the major disasters in the 21st century, you know, the tragedy of 9/11, which was not a natural disaster, but the Katrina hurricane in New Orleans and Superstorm Sandy, which was in New York and New Jersey. And the one thing that is very, very kind of very heartening in the midst of the terrible tragedies is the natural response of Americans and people throughout the world. They want to help. They want to be generous. They want to respond. And that is just such a marvelous thing. And, you know, we really, really want to kind of encourage that generosity. One of the things I'd like to say to our listeners, and, you know, when you see people who are kind of evacuated, people the house there have nothing on their backs, you just want to say, well, wait a minute, I got an extra pair of socks, I have, you know, an extra pillow, I have those things, let me send it down to the people who are there because they really could use it, and why do I need three of them? You know, that instinct, I just want to applaud. It's really, really a very, very good instinct for people to have. I also want to say is that's probably not the best response in terms of actually helping the people who are there. And I know groups are collecting things and but really at the current time, if one wants to be generous, one can make a monetary donation because ultimately that is something that can be very, very useful to the people in the Gulf Coast. And, you know, I will say, I'll give you three organizations that you can send money to, and you'll see a common theme with regard to them. There is Catholic Charities USA. There's Catholic Charities in Houston. And you can give money to Catholic Charities here in New York, and we'll make sure that it gets to help the people who are in Houston. I say that because I have confidence in our organizations that will steward that money very, very well. And, you know, and I want to say this, most nonprofits do steward their money very well. Unfortunately, sometimes some organizations don't, and some people have more confidence in others than others. So I'm not going to mention any of the other organizations. They certainly are advertising. I just want to say you can be sure if you send your money to Catholic Charities USA, Catholic Charities New York, Catholic Charities Houston, it will be used efficiently and it will be used effectively. So that I'll say that. I do want to spend a little bit of time saying that, you know, our Catholic Charities agencies are already responding. And, you know, this is going to sound a little bit contrary to what I just said, but I know Catholic Charities in San Antonio, very near there, has sent a truck of supplies to the people there. And that makes some sense because they're right nearby. They can do it to do that. They also are opening a shelter in San Antonio because sometimes people need to be sheltered, not in the immediate area because there aren't any facilities there. So they've moved them to the next, you know, someplace nearby. You know, if we look at the scope of this thing, you really don't know all of the statistics, but probably, you know, 20 to 30,000 people are currently being sheltered because they had to evacuate their homes and they cannot stay where they are. So, you know, and even far away, and again, as I said, we're not encouraging people to give things, you know, but people do it naturally. So, you know, even here in Catholic Charities New York, we have one of our agencies, Catholic Charities of Staten Island, and for people who are collecting stuff, we're allowing them to use our facility as a place where they can sort stuff and they can package them so that they can be picked up to go to the Gulf Coast. So, you know, our Catholic charities agencies, our Catholic parishes have been responding. And it reminds me after, you know, Hurricane Sandy, when that happened, just the work. And I can just name them, St. Francis de Sales Parish in Bell Harbor, Our Lady of Solace in Coney Island, St. Helena's in Howard Beach, Visitation, St. Mary Star of the Sea in Far Rockaway. All of those parishes just opened their facilities to respond to the needs that are there. It's the natural instinct. And, you know, one of the things that Catholic Charities and our Catholic institutions have is we're in every community, so that when a disaster strikes, we're already there. We have the relationships, we know the geography, we know the people, so there is the ability to really tailor the response to what's going on in those areas. And so, and we already in Catholic Charities New York have, you know, indicated that when it's appropriate, and it's not appropriate for a while, you know, we're going to be putting together a team of people, some of our own staff, some volunteers who can go down to the Houston area for a while to be of assistance, if we're asked, because you always want to work through the local charities, nonprofits, the local governments, the local businesses to make sure that you're going to actually meet the needs of the people that are there. And the other thing I want to say to listeners, you know, do not expect this to be over in 3 weeks. And I'm going to say the recovery in Houston is going to be at least 5 years before things are back to quote unquote normal. And, you know, people are saying, well, how big is it compared with Katrina, those in the Northeast, Sandy? You know, some of those comparisons are, you know, they're nice long after the event happens. But let me say, having kind of experienced the other two natural disasters and looking at what's happening, this is a major, major disaster along the lines of Sandy and Katrina. You know, there's more rain here. Sadly, there were more deaths in Katrina. There was a wider area in New Jersey and New York that was impacted by Sandy. So depending on the criteria that you use, you can make a case for any one of those being the biggest. But the reality is that this is major. And as a country, we need to respond. As a church, we need to respond. You know, I'm going to just say this. I'm so proud when I looked at some of the shelters that were there. I saw, even in that area, one of the churches there had 100 people who were staying overnight. Another had, you know, 200. Churches naturally open their doors to them, and not all Catholic churches. And I will say something negative, okay? Because it was all over the newspaper. I mean, probably the most well-known church in that whole area, the megachurch of Joel Osteen, first decided they couldn't be bothered. I mean, and I'm just reporting what's in the newspaper. And finally, they decided to look at it. And it, quite frankly, it was a little shame because somebody went down and took a picture and there was no water around that church. Well, that's not what a Christian church should be about. We have to go out of our way to sacrifice, to make sure in these situations that that things happen. I mean, I can tell you after 9/11, one of the chapels in the Catholic parishes was there. It was just turned into a place where there was equipment, where people could go and people could really, you know, get ready to do the work that needed to be done there. And the Episcopalian church, the one that was there, Trinity Church, that was there, you know, responded so, so well. So again, the churches are on the ground. They need to respond. Catholic churches, clearly, other Christian churches, and any of the interfaith synagogues, mosques, need to respond. That's our responsibility. Otherwise, we shouldn't call ourselves people of religion. We shouldn't call ourselves people of faith. Enough. This is Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment, and we're going to speak about The Wall with Vanda Felhab Brown, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just, and it will be more compassionate. Our thoughts, our hearts, our prayers go out to the people of Houston, and even though we give thanks to God for the relatively loss of life, the fact that human life was lost is something that we consider a tragedy, and the death toll probably will go up more, but it seems to be much less than some of the other recent natural disasters, and we give thanks to God for that while we are sad for the actual life that was lost. Again, as I said before, and I'll just say very briefly, I know the natural impulse is for people to be generous, and that's great that people are generous. Probably it's not very efficient or effective to give goods at this time. Best thing is a donation, and I'm encouraging people to give to Catholic Charities USA, Catholic Charities Houston, or Catholic Charities New York, and we'll make sure that the money is used to help the people in Houston. So let's now go to our next guest, Vanda Felhab Brown, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. We're going to talk about The Wall. Vanda, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Great. So let's get right into it. So how big is the border between the United States and Mexico? How long is it?
Well, the border is almost 2,000 miles.
Okay.
And, much of the border is actually not land. It is the Rio Grande.
Ah, okay. So you'd have to put the wall on the shore.
Well, that would be the case. That comes with many challenges, many legal issues, problematic environmental issues. So many don't want it. And in fact, the existing fence covers much, not everything, of the land division between the United States and Mexico. But there has been a lot of opposition to put the wall along the Rio Grande.
So okay, I remember that, but I didn't know it. So if you have 2,000 miles of the border, how much of it is the Rio Grande and how much of it is land?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers, but about at least more than half is rivers, including the Rio Grande.
Okay, so it's half. You got to protect half land and half water. What's your current assessment? How, as they say, how porous is the border now?
Well, all borders are porous, and so is the border between the United States and Mexico. As I mentioned, much of the land division, over 700 miles, is currently covered by a fence. That fence is not everywhere, and the fence gets regularly damaged and breached. However, a lot of crossings takes place, a lot of illegal crossings or the smuggling of contraband takes place at legal ports of entry. There are 52 legal ports of entry along the border, and they are, of course, crucial for facilitating the legal movement of people as well as goods and enabling trade. And a lot of smuggling today, both of migrants as well as of drugs and contraband, takes place through the legal ports of entry.
That's a very interesting point. You know, when you say a lot of that, do you have any kind of rough estimate? Is it a third, a half, two-thirds? What are the estimates as to the amount of the illegal stuff coming through the legal points of entry?
Well, I don't know that we actually know that, because a part of the difficulty, of course, is that what is apprehended is just a fraction of illegal flows. But if you look at the documents and assessments of institutions such as the Drug Enforcement Agency, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the principal drug control law enforcement agency in the United States, their own assessment is that most, whatever most means, of drugs are smuggled through legal ports of entry.
And how about people?
These days as well, and in fact that has critical implications for the migrants, significantly worsening their condition. It's tough enough to go through the desert, and smugglers often cut the fence. And as I mentioned, there are parts of the land area which are not fenced because they are critical environmental areas with migration of highly endangered and significant species. But nonetheless, those places are often the mountain places, or desert mountains, or lowland deserts, where many migrants die as a result of not having access to water and food. But it's no easier for them to be smuggled through the legal ports of entry by trucks, where often the drivers would abandon them. They are essentially locked in the truck for several hours. They can face asphyxiation, die of heat stroke, often in really terrible conditions. And there have been multiple instances when immigration officers came close to the trucks, with the drivers abandoning the trucks, with the smugglers abandoning the trucks, and them funding migrants in very bad conditions, and often they have died. So the smuggling through the legal ports of entry is not necessarily any more easier on the migrants. I also want to, however, emphasize a very important point, and that is that President Trump claims that if the wall is built, that will significantly reduce, if not eliminate, the inflow of undocumented people into the United States. Well, over the past 10 years, the majority of people who were in violation of in their immigration status came on visa and overstayed visas. So they came on tourist visas and ended up staying longer and working, or they came on student visas, other temporary forms of visas, and then they violated their immigration status. They never left. And so the wall, even if it worked, and it won't work, but even if it worked, will address not at all this much larger problem of people overstaying or violating their visa status.
So if you were speaking with Vonda Felba Brown, who is Senior Fellow at the Center for 21st Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institute, when we're speaking about the war. Well, Vonda, since you brought it up, so obviously border security is a good thing. It's not good to have people being able to come into the country who shouldn't be coming into the country. That's why they're immigration law. So if the wall won't work, what will work?
Well, actually, there are multiple objectives of border security. In my view, the most significant objective is to prevent terrorism, particularly catastrophic terrorism. And what is most effective for that is actually having good cooperation with your neighbor, having good intelligence sharing with your neighbors.
Okay, Vonda, I hear what you say, but I think for our listeners, they say, well, wait a minute, there are immigration laws. People can come in legally. They can't come in, they shouldn't come in illegally. If you wanted to prevent the flow of illegal people without the right documents coming in or over, what would you do? How would you do that?
Well, I think there are several steps to it. One is getting handle on some monitoring of the visa program that was actually mandated by Congress many years ago, but it was never implemented. So right now, immigration officials, and in fact any enforcement official, has no idea who is overstaying their visa. So simply monitoring, collecting information on who is leaving and entering it into one systematic database, so that it flags people who have overstayed their visa. It's one element of that policy. But the other element is finally getting immigration reform that would provide pathway to citizenship to undocumented people who have lived in the United States often for more than a decade, who have children that have been born here that are U.S. citizens, who have never violated any laws and have been responsible members of the community. And also enabling a visa or building a visa expansion program for people who want to come to work in the United States on a temporary basis, which includes many people from Mexico and Central America that work in sectors such as the fish cutting industry, where there is almost no interest among U.S. native-born to work in that sector. It's a very hard, very difficult job. Or in construction or in agricultural sectors, such as picking fruit, again, another very hard job. The visa programs currently is very limited and not adequate for the needs of U.S. employers. So many of these people would like to come in, earn money into the United States, but then go back to Mexico and, or Central America, wherever they come from, and in fact live there. The paradoxical consequence of tougher border security, including the proposed wall, is that it will likely prevent circular migration of people. So people who would like to come and work temporarily but then go back currently cannot do so easily legally because there are very few visas for temporary work. So they'll do it illegally, but they'll hope to go back to their families and perhaps come again. Well, if the security becomes tighter, then they cannot go back. So they risk, if they manage to get across the border, they will likely be staying for a long time, even as they hope, for example, to send remittances back. So to recap, get a handle on monitoring visa overstaying, expand visas for temporary workers, and conduct a serious immigration reform, including path of citizenship, for people who have lived here for a long time and do not have any criminal violations.
Vonda, thank you so much for being a guest on Just Love. Vonda Felha Brown, the senior fellow at the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institute. Vonda, thank you so much for being a guest on Just Love.
My pleasure.
Great. Well, I'm delighted. It's a little ironic that as we're focused as a country on Texas and Houston and Harvey, that the issue of immigration is oftentimes focused in very much that same area. And, you know, one of the things which somebody pointed out to me earlier today is that there are a fair number of refugees that are resettled in the Houston area, which doesn't surprise me. And so that will be a specific population that kind of needs some help. So it's and I'm delighted we had an opportunity to talk with Vonda about some facts, because on the issue of the wall, what is a little bit concerning to me is that facts seem to be in short supply, at least in the public debate. I mean, two of the facts that that Vonda mentioned, which I think are worth keeping in mind, is that a lot of the people who are now in the country without the right documents are those who came in with the right documents and then just stayed. And when they were supposed to go back after 60 days or so, they didn't. And so they're now here. And, you know, building a wall isn't going to stop that piece. And the other thing which Vonda pointed out is that, you know, most people estimate that, you know, much of the illegal entry of people and drugs from Mexico comes through those 52 legal entries. So, you know, if you build a wall there, you know, I mean, I guess one could argue that you build a wall, you're going to stop some people, but you're not going to get most of the stuff to be dealt with. And that's kind of a pretty important factor, that there is a lot to do to secure the borders without building a wall. And gee, I don't know. When makes most sense is to do those things which are going to have the biggest impact first, and then you go down the line when you have solved a lot of the problem. What are you going to do? But anyway, so and again, from an overall perspective, we want to communicate, yes, security for the borders, legal immigration, but we also want to communicate a welcoming and hospitable approach and a generous immigration policy to the United States. And you know, walls don't communicate that. There are better ways to secure the border. So thank you for being with us. Again, our prayers, our thoughts are with the people in Texas for Hurricane Harvey. If you want to make a contribution, the best way to do it, Catholic Charities USA, Catholic Charities of Houston, Catholic Charities of New York, and we'll make sure that the money is used to help those who are being hurt by that terrible storm down there. Thanks for being with us. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.